His thought turned to the ring, but there was no comfort there, only dread and danger. No sooner had he come in sight of Mount Doom, burning far away, than he was aware of a change in his burden. As it drew near the great furnaces where, in the deeps of time it had been shaped and forged, the ring's power grew. And it became more fell, untamable except by some mighty will. As Sam stood there, even though the ring was not on him but hanging by its chain about his neck, he felt himself enlarged, as if he were robed in a huge, distorted shadow of himself. A vast and ominous threat halted upon the walls of Mordor. He felt that he had, from now on, only two choices. To forbear the ring, though it would torment him, or to claim it, and challenge the power that sat in its dark hold beyond the Valley of Shadows. Already the ring tempted him, gnawing at his will and reason. Wild fantasies arose in his mind, and he saw Samwise the Strong, hero of the age, striding with a flaming sword across the darkened land, and armies flocking to his call as he marched to the overthrow of Barad-dûr. And then all the clouds rolled away, and the white sun shone, and at his command, the Vale of Gorgoroth became a garden of flowers and trees and brought forth fruit. He had only to put on the ring and claim it for his own, and all this could be. In that hour of trial, it was his love of his master that helped most to hold him firm. But also, deep down in him lived still, unconquered, his plain hobbit sense. He knew in the core of his heart that he was not large enough to bear such a burden, even if such visions were not a mere cheat to betray him. The one small garden of a free gardener was all his need and due, not a garden swollen to a realm, his own hands to use, not the hands of others to command. "And anyways, all these notions are only a trick," he said to himself. Excerpt concerning Samwise Gamgee from J.R.R. Tolkien's masterwork, The Return of the King. Well, welcome back to another episode of Bright Hearth here, coming to the tail end of season one, where we've been talking about recovering the lost arts of domesticity in the productive Christian household. Today, I'm actually not joined by my lovely wife, Lexi, and you'll see why here in just a minute. But if you've been listening, you'll know that one of the themes that's really run through this season is that the productive Christian household and free sovereign Christian households are one of the chief enemies of the big government statist apparatus that really will do everything it can to try and crush, destroy, co-opt, buy off, whatever it can do to destroy productive Christian households because they make really bad slaves. Productive Christian households make really bad slaves, and that's what they want. They want slaves and serfs on their plantations. And so part of fighting back against that centralizing enslaving force is the building of free, sovereign, productive Christian households with strong men, with fruitful women, recovering the arts and disciplines that build these kinds of households together. And so if you're listening, you're probably on our team here. You probably want to be less dependent on people who hate you, on systems that would want to enslave you, enemies who would seek to geld you and make you serfs. And so that's why we're excited about our guest today, Jason Matthias. He's a guy we think you should be listening to and following. And because not only has he been involved in teaching and filmmaking and educating people on a lot of these fronts, but he's also put his money where his mouth is and actually not just talked about it, but built a successful family business around a household that is really just a wonderful model of all of what this actually looks like with his wife, Shannon, and their seven kids. And so in this episode, we're going to be talking about his work in some of these areas, as well as the story of building his own family business and their household, and how we can learn from his experience as we together pursue freedom and productivity in our household. So with that, welcome to the show, Jason. We're honored to have you on.
Hey, Brian, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we connected at a County Before Country in Ohio, and that was where I first kind of learned about you and what you were doing there. But immediately within like 30 seconds of starting to talk to you, I was like, we need to get this guy on Bright Hearth.
Yeah, it was great to meet you there, and really appreciated the time you spent with me in this conversation. And I'm glad that I can contribute to what you're doing. I really appreciate your effort that you and Lexi are doing to help get people to recage their thinking in a biblical way, and to move away from the excesses and in many ways depravity of modernity.
Well, thank you so much. And we can jump right in here, I think, with really one of the best ways to frame and help people understand kind of what you're aiming for. I think we can get from one of the projects you were involved in a few years ago at this point, the film Beyond Off Grid. And we'll have some links for everybody where you can find the film and support what you guys are up to. So definitely check those out as well. But can you tell us about some of the big ideas behind that film and why it might be a help to our listeners to go check it out?
Sure. So just for those who haven't heard of me before, just a tiny bit of background to give some context to all this. So I went to Cornell, and after I graduated from college, I went into the Air Force. I did ROTC in college, and I became an Air Force pilot. I flew KC-10 refueling tankers, and I basically got qualified in the aircraft in 99. And so I was flying for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, when 9/11 happened. And quickly life changed very fundamentally, because we went from a relative peacetime operations to the highest operations tempo that the U.S. has had really since World War II. So as a mobility pilot, I was flying all over the world. I was going from deployment to overseas trips back to back. And the year after 9/11, the 2 years after 9/11, I was basically gone about 70% of the time. So it was in that time, actually, I got married, and then we had our first child. And so it quickly became apparent to me that the way life is going to be for the foreseeable future was going to be a lot of time away from family. And my desire really was to raise my fear in my family and the fear and admonition of the Lord, my children, and disciple them, and to work with my wife to create a productive household. But when you're gone all the time, it's kind of hard to do that. So when I got to the end of my military commitment, where I could separate from the Air Force, I was actually kind of on the fast track to command and general officer and all that. And I had to kind of turn that down to pursue a less traveled path, and certainly a less guaranteed path in terms of provision. But I really just felt that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to have the time with my family, to have the kind of family life that I felt God was requiring of me. And so I left active duty in 2008 and went into the Air Force Reserve. So that provided some income. I pursued a more entrepreneurial path. I looked at kind of corporate job settings, but none of them were going to fundamentally change the equation. I was still going to be answering to somebody else for my time commitments and all that kind of stuff, and climbing the corporate ladder instead of the military career ladder. And so I decided to pursue an entrepreneurial path. And that is for sure a much more risky path. And for a lot of people, that is often the hang up. But for me, it was really a matter of calling. Like, I sensed the duty to pursue that. So fast forward, I did a bunch of different things, got some business experience with another Christian entrepreneur. I started doing consulting work from home. But our family had already been started this journey about 15 plus years ago, after our first couple of children were born, where we were starting to eat more healthy and starting to trying to buy food locally. And we were kind of that early echelon of like the local food movement. And growing up, my parents had a garden my whole upbringing. We even had layer hens, and I grew up in Southern California. So it's kind of a unique thing. But I really felt the calling to not only eat healthier, but to try to, you know, move towards that more productive household model, which is one of the reasons I wanted more flexibility in my time. And so one thing led to another, and around 2012 or 13, a mutual friend introduced me to a guy who had started this film project called Beyond Off Grid, which is loosely based conceptually on a book by Michael Bunker called Surviving Off Grid. And he's featured in the film. And it really synced with this journey that our family was on, and that I really felt called to, which was to try to relocalize a lot of our economy, especially around food, and to try to be more productive as a household. And so some of the skills and experience that God had given me in the previous years lended well to being involved, especially on the business side of that film. And so I jumped in, and we started working on it. Extremely low budget. It was a big sacrifice. But in the end, what ended up happening was, we interviewed a lot of people who had been doing this kind of productive household thing in various shapes, manners, and forms. They either became mm-hmm. farmers or small business owners, and they had expertise to share in this idea of that modernity has basically bifurcated much of life into not just the spiritual and the secular, so to speak, but just in terms of separating families, fathers from homes, and even mothers from homes as two-income households become the norm. And the only way to kind of get out of the rat race, to get away from the excesses and depravity of modernity, as I said before, is to make a conscious decision to change the way you live, is to change your lifestyle. And so all of the people we interviewed in the film all talked to various aspects of this. But we had filmed most of the interviews, and we're kind of looking at the footage and figuring out how we're going to kind of write and edit the script to make this thing work. And I kind of figured at a big picture level, this is back in 2013-14. So the economy was doing great. People were, you know, kind of fat, dumb, and happy, as they say.
Yeah.
And not really thinking about these things. So I'm thinking, okay, if we're going to be talking about this lifestyle change stuff, like, there's a very, very small percentage of people that are even interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
So how are we actually going to make an impact on as many people as possible with this film? Because a lot of what the interviews were, was, you know, here's, some of it was the, what are we, why are we doing this? But a lot of it was like, how do you go about making these lifestyle changes? And I realized that, you know what, we really need to tell people the why first.
Yeah.
So they have ears to hear the what and the how. And mm-hmm. so we ended up basically rewriting the entire script and putting, I ended up having to be featured in the film because there was a lot of footage that we didn't have enough interview footage to kind of say what we wanted to say in terms of painting that picture. And so I ended up being kind of like a host role in the film that wasn't originally planned. I didn't plan on being involved in the film that level of detail, but I did. And God pulled me into that. So the first half of the film really is talking about what is going on with modern America today. And again, realize this is mm-hmm. mid-20-teens, early to mid-20-teens. And everything seemed great on the surface, right? But the reality is, if you look at it in historical context, and the historical context that we chose to use for this was comparing the modern American empire to the late Roman Empire before the fall of the Western Empire. And if you look at the similarities between those two, they are eerily striking. There are so many different ways. We chose five different kind of categories to put comparisons in. But whether you're looking at like the economy, the foreign adventurism and war making, looking at the social depravity, all these different things are almost identical, more or less, to what was going on in the Roman Empire when people thought it was invincible and at its peak of development. And literally just a few years or decades later, literally there were barbarians, you know, entering the gates of Rome as the people were in the Colosseum watching the games. And so the idea of comparing modern America to that late Roman Empire seems kind of like to Americans, of course, they don't know the water they swim in, right?
Yeah.
There, a lot of people are just kind of, you kind of say that, you're like, they would say, oh, well, whatever. Like, even if they've studied history. Mm-hmm. But when you actually, you know, spend some time to go through it and kind of catalog and describe, hey, this is what's going on in America, and this is what was happening then, it makes a lot more sense. And so the first half of the film is really all about this kind of painting the picture that modern America, though it looks powerful and mighty and at the height of its development, American civilization and largely civilization of the West, it looks civilized, but what it is really a thin veneer of civilization over a rotting corpse of what was Western civilization. And particularly it's the rotting corpse of secularism that had taken over Western civilization. Right.
I thought that was the way that you guys framed that. Why was really compelling in going through the, how have, you know, how have like greed and desire for comfort worked to enslave us, the parallels historically with centralism, money, slavery, war machine to focus our hatred on outside forces while they, you know, concealing the robbery of liberties at home, all of that economic plundering. That was very compelling.
Thank you. Yeah, it really, there's so much there that you could do a 10-part documentary series on it, an hour each, and still only kind of scratch the surface. So the biggest challenge with the film was that we were just trying to pack so much into 90 minutes. And it really only does scratch the surface. But the thing we wanted to try to do is to try to kind of, you know, kind of wake people up who had eyes to see or ears to hear, at least a little bit, to kind of be that glitch in the matrix, so to speak, where, and frankly, again, this is quite a few years ago before the events of the past few years. And there's been lots of glitches in the matrix since then. Right. But the reality is that all of the conditions that ended up coming to the fore manifesting in 2020 and 2021 and that we're experiencing right now were all there before. We just didn't have the trigger events or the catalyst to cause the problems with the centralization and other negative aspects of modernity. I mean, don't get me wrong, they have plenty of positive benefits, mm-hmm. but the dependency upon centralization and government and all these other manifestations of the modern economic system in the West, people didn't realize how fragile they were mm-hmm. until there was the catalyst to cause the breakdown of those systems. And you see this particularly in the food system and, you know, late March and April of 2020, I mean, things just started breaking down tremendously. And I think that's, there was already kind of a growing interest in gardening and being, you know, relocalizing your food supply through local farms and that kind of stuff. But man, that just put it on steroids. And people went to the store and saw like no meat on the shelves. And there was just a you know, massive shortages, even if they're short lived. People realized, oh, I thought I could always get whatever I wanted any time of year when I go to the store. And the reality is that the just-in-time supply chain and all of the aspects of centralization are very efficient and work very well as long as everything's working correctly. But as soon as you start throwing a wrench in the monkey wrench in the gears of that system, lots of negative impacts start happening. And they were so widespread a couple of years ago and continuing even into today, we're feeling the reverberations of it that I think that's really what's led a lot of people to seriously consider changing their lifestyle, whether it's gardening or buying food from local farmers. And frankly, a lot of people are being forced to do this because their budgets are being pinched and food has gotten so insanely expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, even the FDA earlier this year, in an FDA published study showed that food costs were on average up 32% in 1 year.
Wow.
Which is way over what the published inflation rate is. So anybody who's paying attention and does grocery shopping is well aware of the problems, right? And if you're not upper middle class or above, you know, that you're being faced with some of these realities on a daily basis. And so I appreciate you actually taking a bit of a detour in a way from what you've been talking about this season to talk about some of these issues in a recent episode and also to have me on to talk about them some more. Because I think it's one of the most important things that people need to be looking at is how are they going to deal with the crisis, the food crisis in many ways that we're currently experiencing and that's going to get worse over this winter. A lot of people don't realize that we're entering a period of global famine. And if you don't have plans on how you're going to deal with that for your family and your community, then you need to wake up and start working on it right away.
Yeah. So much of, you know, we talk a lot about, at least in our local church context, we've talked a lot about how the last 2 years, they haven't created, I think some people think, oh, the last 2 years have created all these problems. And you say, no, the last 2 years have been an apocalypse, meaning the word apocalypse literally means revealing or unveiling.
Exactly.
They've just revealed, you poke the painted external and you realize the wood's all rotten underneath the paint. And you can keep putting paint over it, but there are systemic, serious, structural issues that make us very vulnerable. And, you know, historically, we as Americans can forget that the story of human history isn't a story of ease and comfort and security. it's often, you know, those things can really be an aberration in many places and times in history. So, you know, I think it is a wake up for many. You know, a lot of our listeners are probably new to the idea of the productive Christian household. Even in the last 5 years, I think probably 80%+ of the people I know today who are concerned with these things, they weren't necessarily concerned with them 5-10 years ago. So I think that it's important that we get, as the interest rises with the revealing of the apocalyptic sort of revealings, that we have actionable, okay, here's where to go. Here's what we need to do. Here are some systems to get in place. Here's how to be thinking. And one of the themes of our show and really, you know, of our lives is just, it's not, you're not going to fix everything tomorrow, but you can do the next thing. Like, take the next step. Don't get overwhelmed, but by the, you know, sometimes you can hear some of this stuff and get overwhelmed and freak out, but what is the next thing we can do? How can we, you know, just progressively over time actually respond to some of these things and not just put our hands over our eyes or, you know, stick our head in a hole in the sand and just say, well, that's not happening. I don't need to do anything. The government will take care of me. We'll all be fine.
Yeah, I think the past couple of years have borne out that that is a naive at best response.
Absolutely. You talked a lot in the documentary about how essentially what the trajectory of modernity has been a trajectory towards this sort of modern feudalism, where basically we end up being serfs on some lord's plantation. And the one of the big answers is, well, you actually have to take responsibility to fight against that. So maybe a lot of this actually starts to overlap with some of what you and your family have personally done in taking responsibility for your household and starting a home business. And so maybe you could talk us through, like, how did this look for you in seeing these problems and then saying, well, we actually have to do something about them? What did that process look for you? What did you guys do? And maybe, you know, I think that'll be helpful to our listeners to just hear practically, like, okay, what can you do?
So there's a couple different aspects to this. I'll start with the kind of the immediate concerns or reasons I had to pursue this. And I already touched on this a little bit before, which is, you know, why did I leave a very secure career with the military on track to be, you know, a colonel or a general officer, that, you know, we would have, all our physical needs would have been taken care of.
Yeah.
It was not, you know, it was primarily because I prioritized my, my duties and my calling above personal peace and affluence, to borrow the phrase from Francis Schaeffer, right? Mm-hmm. If we're just thinking about what is going to give me the greatest income, what will allow me to have the best standard of living, those kind of things, essentially you've already conceded to the first step of the trap, right? Mm-hmm. The trap of modernity is you becoming dependent upon modern centralized systems, whatever they may be, whether that's government or corporate influence and, you know, corporate secure job security, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's so many other aspects of that. So for me, it was really, how am I best going to fulfill my primary duties and calling as a husband and a father, to not just provide for the physical needs of my family, but actually to have time with them, to be involved in the education of my children, which I would not have been largely if I'd been gone all the time.
Yeah.
How do I, you know, help develop this sense of family culture that is, I don't want to teach my children just academically, right? I want to give them character and skills and the ability to solve problems, because that is what the future needs. Like, we need to be, as parents, we need to be raising not just kids who can pass a test or can get a job, but those who can see what's going on in the world and look at the problems and creatively problem solve to lead the way forward and to build Christ's kingdom. So,
yeah,
you know, I think every homeschooler in particular should be looking at how they're going about doing that and maybe reassess how you're making educational decisions in light of that. So for us, and me in particular, that was one of the big things. So as far as I'm kind of a prototypical entrepreneur, I'm a visionary thinker. I love starting things. The routine, habitual day to day doing the same thing over and over bores me. And so, you know, I've got my own challenges in terms of that is still one of the most important things you can do. And no matter what you do in life, is create good habits and stick to them. But, you know, I love seeing problems and creating solutions and jumping in and starting getting things rolling to start solving those problems. And, you know, what that looked like for me when I left the military active duty is I got some experience with another Christian entrepreneur, a homeschool dad, that was super helpful. And that led to me being able to do contract work part time. And so we were able to kind of go anywhere. And so we moved to Virginia, and about 12 years ago, and got involved with another homeschool dad doing a startup, like an independent film distribution startup that didn't end up succeeding due to a variety of factors, but it was a great fit for my skills and my passions and the ability to gain a lot of skills that were really helpful for future endeavors, including the film project. I mean, the reason why I got involved in the film project, why the director of photography and the guy who started it asked me to join it, was because I had some experience with film distribution and marketing films. Mm-hmm. So there was that. And then about the same time, about 2013 is when we started the film or the seed business. And really, so here's kind of, this, I think this is revealing for people, you know, why did we start a seed business? Well, the reality is I've been gardening my entire life. My wife grew up on a farm. She didn't have as much involvement in the gardening, but it was kind of like normal from her family background. And so like, I literally, other than when I was in college and when I was in pilot training, I've had a garden. Even when I was a new lieutenant, at my first duty assignment, I had a little vegetable garden in a flower bed, and I was growing tomatoes and peppers and that kind of stuff. And every place we went after that, we'd have a garden, wherever we could, to the scale we were able to tend it. Right. And so this kind of our family heritage, our family culture had growing food and real food is an integral part of it. And so around that time, I was looking for opportunities, not just to make money, but I was looking for opportunities for having my children work with me in a family business where they can learn skills that would be part of their educational endeavors. Learn a lot of practical skills and then be able to contribute to the family economy. So that was really the reason that the seed business came about, is because we were already gardening, we were already saving seeds. And it kind of hit me one day. I'm like, we're already doing this. We already love this as a family. You know, the kids can help pack seed packets and help with shipping orders and that kind of stuff. So it started very small scale. And for a very long time, for really, 5-6 years, it was just a part-time thing. It dovetailed really well with the film project, because when we would go to events, I'd often go to like homesteader or preparedness events or expos, and I would speak on different topics related to the film. And we would have a booth to not just promote the film, but we'd also have our seed business there. So there's a nice complementary aspect to it. And I'd always encourage people, when you're looking at family business opportunities, look for things that are complementary with one another, particularly with the interest and skills that your family already has. So that was real beneficial for us. And, you know, after the film was completed, the film actually had a huge opportunity cost and probably set back the growth of the seed business in some ways and other things for a while, just because it was, again, it's one of these things where, you know, you're not going to make millions of dollars and get a Hollywood blockbuster out of this.
Right.
Film,
it's right.
Very, very outside the box and countercultural and counter everything.
Yeah. You're not going to get like Kellogg's to come and say, buy an ad on your, on your documentary.
Yeah, saying, for sure.
Hey, so don't support massive big government subsidized centralization. Yeah. Not a lot of money to be made.
The film was really a labor of love, and the Lord has blessed it tremendously. But there was a cost to, you know, the amount of time I had for developing other business ventures and stuff. So I was doing consulting and other contract work kind of on the side. And basically what ended up happening is in 2020, when the lockdowns that are happening and the food system started shutting down because of government intervention. I always point that out. It wasn't COVID like the virus, right?
It was the virus.
What did the government do? And so, you know, when packing plants start shutting down, I mean, a lot of people didn't realize before that there's just a handful of companies that do, you know, 90%+ of the meat processing in the country. And a lot of these are done at these mega facilities, very, very centralized processing. And when you have something like a contagious disease that, you know, they're either workers are getting sick or they're basically reducing staff levels and throughput because of government restrictions and things, you know, it has a direct impact on the output of those production facilities. So basically, long story short, is in 2020, our business just exploded. There was such a tremendous explosion in the interest of both growing your own food as well as looking to buy it locally, because people were looking for alternatives. And so I know a lot of farmer friends who basically, you know, they could sell anything that they had, no problem. The problem again was with animals in particular was processing. It's hard to find enough product capacity in the butcher shops and those kind of things to handle it. So in the seed industry, basically there was like an explosion. I don't know what it ended up being, but it was something like, you know, hundreds of percent increase. And what happened is the big guys that most people know, the big seed sellers, you know, if you got dozens or triple digit employees, you know, you have some ability to surge your fulfillment and what you're doing, but you can't 2 or even 3x very quickly because you have to hire so many more people. So a lot of those seed sellers were having basically just shut down for a couple of days to a couple of weeks, not take any orders. And people were freaking out and trying to find where they could buy seeds. And so a lot of our customers would, you know, we basically grew through word of mouth. People found that we were still open and still selling. And at the time we were part-time and we had to take a break from homeschooling for a little while to be able to deal with the order demand. But we were up 8 to 10x in sales for a couple of months.
Today's so class God really, is going to be on packing seed packets, kids.
Yeah. And we had to call in some friends in our neighborhood to, you know, kind of help us out with surge capacity. But overall, God just tremendously blessed us with a huge like echelon jump.
Yeah.
We had already been growing at a good clip, about doubling every year, but it still wasn't enough for a full-time income. So I was still doing other work. And then basically it went full-time in, you know, a matter of months. And so since for the past, you know, 2+ years, we've been just really focusing on the seed business and growing our own production on our homestead and our farm. And then, you know, you mentioned me teaching and things like I've been doing for 7, 8, 9 years. I've been teaching in every opportunity that I can, really, whether it's in-person events or online summit events, you know, sharing about gardening and homesteading and self-reliance, because I could see ahead and I could see, you know, I don't know when the breakdown of the system is going to happen, but I know that it's unsustainable. So logically, at some point, be it a few years or a few decades, it's going to, and I didn't think it was going to last a few decades, but it's going to start unraveling. People need to start building the skills that they need to be able to deal with the negative impacts of the unraveling that's going to happen. And it just so happens that God used the whole COVID thing as a way to start unraveling those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think the need is both one of high importance, but it's also one of high urgency that people start reassessing how they not only acquire food. I think a lot of the movement towards growing food or sourcing it locally was kind of out of wanting to eat healthier and having healthier options. But there's a lot of other factors that play into it now. I mean, the reality is that, you know, sustainably produced agricultural products, whether it's garden produce, vegetables or meat, used to be a lot more expensive because that industrial system is so efficient, right? But because of the breakdowns in that system, now the prices have raised to the point where the sustainably produced products are on par in terms of price with those industrial products. But the sustainably locally produced options are so much higher quality.
Yeah.
That I think that this is like a great opportunity for people to, you know, essentially the excuse of it's too expensive has gone away, because all of the industrially produced food has risen in price so much in the past couple of years that just from a budget perspective, people certainly need to start looking at alternatives. And, you know, one of the best ways you can have a productive household is to, you know, grow where you're planted, so to speak. You know, God has given you the place where you live. And literally, even if it's an apartment in the city, you can grow something.
Yeah.
And I think that just taking that little bit of ground that God's given you and being a good steward of it, not only produces a beneficial and often tasty byproduct or outcome of it, mm-hmm. but I think it helps change our perspective to where we see that we can take something small and grow it into something that's necessary, that's needed, that's productive, that's fruitful in a way that a lot of other things in the modern economy do not. I mean, it's just physically planting a seed and seeing it grow into a fruit is a physical reminder of how God created this world and how we can be, you know, partakers of and stewards in it. And so I think everybody should be growing something, even if it's just like a window box with herbs or something. You know, everybody can start at a small level and work from there.
Yeah. Even if it's just didactic, I mean, to the degree that you get disconnected by seven layers of bureaucracy and middlemen from the actual earth that you live on, you really end up disconnecting yourself from so many of the sermons that God is preaching in his creation and in his world. And so even if just for that, I think it's worth like actually learning how does your food come to grow? What does it look like for a plant to grow? What does it need? And there's so much, there's so many sermons. Like I said, I just think like the creation is preaching. And mm-hmm. if you shut your ears to all of it, not only are there all these other issues that we've pointed out already, but man, it's like you're missing out on seeing and reveling in all of these glories that God has worked in. And even one of the things I like about your company, Seeds for Generations, and we'll put a link there for you guys to go check out what's happening there. And obviously, you can buy your seeds. And if you don't already have a Christian company that you buy your seeds from and you're looking to like actually support, here's a real household that you can say, I know that when I spend dollars on radish seeds this year or kale or Brussels sprouts or cabbage, that those are dollars that are going to support a Christian family doing Christian things. So check that out. But I also appreciated when I went to your website for the first time, the tools that you have for learning, the gardening resources, the books that you guys have up there. I mean, it looks like you guys have some tools up there for even things that are very practical, like fall planting, succession planting on there. So maybe you could give some advice to our listeners who are looking to get into just the practical. They want to grow things. They want to get into this, you know, growing, whether it's a garden box at their window or full-scale garden that they want to provide and trade within their local church. And how can they get started? What kind of resources should they be looking at, reading, and how would you direct them?
Yeah, it's a great question. If people have never gardened before, it can be a little overwhelming. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that and this kind of goes back to what we were talking before about the mindset issues, a lot of which we talk about in the film. People have to understand that what we're experiencing today is not normal from a historical perspective, like the history of humanity, right? Mm. You have to understand that literally from the beginning of creation, for thousands of years, up until less than 100 years ago, having a garden and growing some of your own food was normal
for
almost everyone. it wasn't until like post-World War II that it quickly fell out of common practice. In fact, you know, if you know anything about World War II, the government literally had a propaganda campaign for victory gardens for people to grow their own vegetables. Yeah. The reason being is that they needed as much food production as possible, particularly because all the men were gone at war. And so I think if we kind of think about what's happening today at the big picture level, there's really like this war on humanity as it has existed for thousands of years, and that we're kind of victims of, and that the way that we try to regain what has been lost and try to build Christ's kingdom in some ways is to almost like you, if you think about your garden as a victory garden in the war for reclaiming God's creation, I think it could be helpful in terms of like the mental motivation for doing it.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be challenges along the way, no matter what you do.
I can confirm that.
Yeah. So I just start with that because I think it's important that we kind of consider like, where are we at and what is normal from a human history perspective, and realize that, you know, starting a garden may not be normal for you and your family, your immediate family history, what like you have known, maybe your parents have done, but pretty much, you know, either your grandparents or your great grandparents had a garden, almost guaranteed. And then before that, it was like everyone, right? Yep. They were either farmers or they had a backyard garden. So it's normal. And I think we all need to think of it as like, it's one of these normal things that people do, that everybody does, that you're normal, you're not weird. So if you think about those terms, I think it can be helpful just from a perspective of, you know, this is something I need to be doing because this is what people have always done for all of time.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So in terms of resources, I'd say the first thing, is start where you're at, like start where you're at. A lot of people will make excuses because they say, oh, well, I don't have a yard that I can put a garden in, or I live in an apartment and I don't have any access to land or whatever. So the first thing is start where you're at. Don't make excuses. Be a problem solver. So if the problem is I don't have any yard because I live in an apartment or a townhouse or something, or maybe even, you know, my house is in we have an HOA and they don't let us have gardens or something like that. Don't worry. There's ways around that.
Yeah.
If nothing else, there's community gardens where you can basically like pay a small fee for a little plot and grow there. And often that's a great way to build community as well. But you know, I'm going to kind of gear this towards kind of your average person.
Yeah.
You know, they've got a little bit of a yard, assuming they've got it gets some sun. It's not completely covered in trees, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, at this time of year, we're entering fall. It's not the normal time to be planting stuff. However, everybody can grow things in containers and even during the winter, and herbs are a great place to start, to be honest with you. Just like a few simple culinary herbs, even if you buy them, it's harder to get this time of year, but even if you just buy them at a garden center, but you know, most herbs are fairly easy to plant and start in pots, from seed, and start, you know, put it in a sunny window and start growing herbs. And, you know, your food's going to taste way better with fresh herbs than it is from, you know, whatever you buy already dried and ready to use. But that is something simple that everybody should be doing because the studies have shown that if you have like plants in your home, they facilitate, you know, good moods and energy and all that kind of stuff. So, have some potted herbs or flowers or something. And particularly with like stuff that you can eat, right? Herbs are easy. They don't take that much room. You don't use a whole lot of them when you're using small amounts. So it's something you can even do through the winter. For a lot of people, if they're just starting doing, and in particular, one of the challenges some people have is they don't have good soil where they're at. You know, just doing some small raised beds. And this can be even like, you know, you can turn some flower beds into growing space for vegetables and grow, you know, some tomatoes and peppers during the summer. There's all kinds of stuff that you can grow in small spaces that can be a huge benefit to your household. In terms of what to buy, You know, if you're starting small and you have a limited amount of space, I'd say grow what you eat the most, like what your most common, commonly eaten vegetables are, which for a lot of people, if they like salad, would be like lettuce and other greens. Also, what is most expensive to buy, especially if you're buying things organic, because, you know, if you're growing food yourself, you can make it organic really easily. You just don't spray it with chemicals. And often organic stuff is quite a bit more expensive in the store. So one of the things to think about how this plays into the productive household is that it's not just bringing income into the family that is important to be thinking about how you can do that. It's also how you can save money or redirect your resources. So growing a garden can end up reducing the amount of money spent outside the household on food quite significantly, especially if you eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. So this is one thing that you can help use in your head to kind of justify the dollar and the time cost involved in getting started gardening, is that in almost every case, you're essentially paying yourself to grow food. Like you're literally getting paid for your time, because otherwise you'd be spending it on food that you're buying in the store. Now, it may not be as convenient, but there's a lot of other benefits to growing it yourself, including just, you know, exercise activity, having your hands in the dirt and enjoying God's creation. All those things are intangible things that end up having a benefit as well.
Yeah.
As far as resources, we've got some good books on our website. One of the great, great ones that we always feature, especially if people are just getting started and don't have a lot of background. The book is called The Family Garden Plan by Melissa Norris. She's a homesteader and out in Washington State. And her book is really great because it kind of gives you a lot of great introductory stuff, but then it has a lot of great resources and planning information and charts and reference information, all that kind of stuff. And it's really, really handy to get you started. There's also a companion garden planner notebook that she has for that, that we sell. If you, especially if you like, you know, tactile paper, writing down notes and recording all your data in something physical, that's a really fantastic resource. We've also got a book on canning. So if you're going to start doing food preservation, we've got a book on winter gardening, which is, you know, basically how do you keep growing stuff even when it's cold outside, whether that's in the fall before the frost or after the frost. There's lots of methods you can use to extend your season past when it would normally be. And then we also have a bunch of planning resources that we've created on our website. So in the fall, we have a fall planting calculator that will help you determine when is your latest planting date for different crops. So if you're basically, you know, kind of in the South or Texas or maybe California, they have longer growing seasons. Like you may still, even though we're past officially the first day of fall, there may be things that you can grow. And especially a lot of crops that really like cool weather, things like lettuce and spinach and other greens that you have in salads. Those things actually prefer cooler weather, and it may not be too late to plant those where you're at. So that tool will help you figure out when those dates are. We've also got some other resources there that help you with, you know, when to plant in the spring. If you want to keep a harvest of a certain crop coming, like lettuce, you know, when should you be planting it? You can plant multiple batches of crops to keep them coming throughout your growing season, which is really good for things like lettuce that you're eating on a routine basis.
Yeah.
And that, don't preserve, right? You just eat them fresh. And then, I also do lots of training. So, particularly after the new year, when people are starting to plan their gardens and stuff, we have a bunch of webinars that I teach. So, you know, if you go to, the link that you're going to provide, we're going to have a page there with a bunch of different resources people can get access to, and they can sign up on our email list. So they hear whenever we have, you know, either seasonally appropriate training or resources available, or if we're having a sale, or if we get new products in, we're trying to add new books and other products on a regular basis. So all those things, you know, you can find out about as soon as they come out by being on our email list. But the biggest thing I'd say is, you know, just start where you're at and don't make excuses.
Yeah.
Do what you can with what you can, with what you have, and then just try to increase it a small amount, like each season. And, you know, some people find that once they start growing things, they really love it, and then they just, you know, really increase a lot I think there is caution to be said. The times we live in can make a lot of people feel like they need to basically start doing what my family is doing, where we're, you know, growing a half an acre worth of garden yeah. space, and we're raising animals and all these other things, like right away. That's for most people, that's not the answer, because that's right. like a full-time job.
Yeah.
So it's important that you don't bite off more than you can chew. And it's much better to start with a small space and manage it well than it is to create a huge space that then becomes unmanageable.
Yeah.
And that often is the case as far as like weeds go. There, by the way, speaking of books, there's a great book by John Moody,
called
Winning the War, on Weeds. He's got a non-chemical, non-tillage approach to weed control. That's really fantastic. And if you're getting started, that's actually a great thing to read early, because it will help, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yes.
His approach is really all about prevention. Like, how do you prevent weeds from becoming an issue? So that usually is the nemesis or the thorn in the side of gardeners, especially new gardeners who yeah. are trying to do a lot right away. Is managing a weed competition. So that's another great resource. And
I think that's such good advice, because a lot of the time, this is just human. We look at a problem and we say, like, okay, this season I'm going to completely solve this problem. And then you jump in whole hog, you spend $1,500 on all your gardening stuff that year. And then you just like utterly fail, because you tried to do the work of 10 years in 6 months. And instead, just doing the next thing, you know, doing the education first and saying, oh, okay, I'm going to learn from some people that have the first time gardening guides, and here's some pitfalls to avoid. And then you can have an enjoyable experience that really gives you more motivation to continue. And then, yeah, 5 years in, I know there are families in our church that they were doing almost, you know, maybe a few herbs here and there, and now they've got two different types of livestock, and they're growing a bunch of food. They're trading and wheeling and dealing in the community. And, you know, they've got layers and doing meat chickens. And it's like, they didn't do that all in 6 months, but mm-hmm. they did it in a sustainable and, you know, approachable way. And now they're having a good time, and they've learned as they've gone. And man, just like, it's such a blessing. Another thing, I think it's such a blessing to a community. Even if you don't, you're not going to get everybody in your church to care about growing things in 10 minutes. But man, if five or six families in a local church plan together and care about these sorts of things, over time, you can really change the culture, and you can make a meaningful impact in people's lives and food chains, serve your neighbor, and just demonstrate the value of some of the things that we're talking about with your, not just like constantly talking at everybody and like going up to your neighbor at the potluck and hitting the corn chips out of his hand and saying, like, don't you know that Monsanto and you know, yeah. like no, win them. Don't go scorched earth. Win your friends, win your neighbors, win your family. But there's just so much there that I'm looking right now at your book section. And let me encourage you guys, if you're listening to this and you're like, yes, I need to get that family garden plan, don't go on Amazon. Don't do it. Go buy it from Seeds for Generations, and keep it in the family. So I'll give you that plug as well
before
you go. You know, I know we all do it. You're like, oh, that book, perfect, I got it on Amazon. No, don't do it, guys. Let's beat Bezos.
It was something you mentioned made me think about something that I wanted to touch on, which is, you're talking about just, you know, several families in the church doing this and the blessing they can be. A lot of people don't realize, I think they're starting to realize maybe now, but, you know, most households spend a lot of money on food.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think, Franklin Sanders is one of the guys we interviewed for a film, and he's always foot stomping this, which is, you know, the foundation of any economy is food. Because it is the ultimate essential that everybody needs yeah. to have, you know, water, food, shelter. And I think the numbers are probably a lot more now, especially because of food inflation. But as of several years ago, something like every person in a household, the average is like $2,500 a year in food. And if you think about it, if you take even just a small portion of that, and instead of just going through the normal modern food distribution system and spending all your money there, you reallocate some of that to local producers, particularly if they're in your church, right? In your church community, you're blessing other believers. Most even small church congregations could support several full-time farmers.
Yes.
If they reallocated, actually made an effort to reallocate a lot of their food dollars to local producers. And this is one of these things where if we want to be able to create resilience, not just in our households, but in our communities, we have to vote with our dollars.
Yes.
And the biggest like market sector that we can do that in, simply because of the amount of money that's spent in it, is with food. You know, you can't necessarily buy local or buy from somebody you know with like technology products and fuel and all that other stuff, but food, you know, that can be produced in local communities. And I think everybody should be making an effort to grow what they can themselves and try to source as much as they can beyond that from local producers, because it helps bring the food dollars back into the local economy. And then that ends up enabling all other kinds of local businesses, because those dollars are recirculating in a local economy instead of all going to the corporate centers and big cities to fund the wickedness of the elites that are, you know, running the show. So that's a really important aspect. And one other thing I'll mention here, I've got a whole training that's called How to Relocalize Your Food Supply.
Oh, it's great.
And it goes into a lot of detail about how you go about doing this. Like, what are your different options that you should be looking for in your local area? So we'll put that on the page that you're going to link to. Perfect. So people can watch that training if they're interested in learning more. And there's a lot of other resources we mentioned in that as well that can be helpful to people. Because I think this is really like the need of our day. You know, people really need to be looking at how they can be helping to insulate ourselves from a lot of the failing systems that we've become so accustomed to providing for us, and helping to create resilience within our households first, and then secondarily within our local communities, so that we can be strengthening the foundation of support that's needed to weather the storms that are coming. And obviously we've already had storms recently, but I think they're just going to continue to develop, and we need to be working together to try to prepare for being ready for the future waves and winds that are coming.
Man, that is so true. There's so much meat on the bone in this episode for you guys listening to chew on, and I think really make a meaningful difference in your family and your community. There's just a lot here. So thanks for your time, Jason. We really appreciate it. And I do just want to one more time encourage everybody listening, Go to Seeds for Generations, their website. We'll have a link there in the description for you. Go check it out. Get a book. Get some seeds. If you're planting a garden this year, try to support this Christian business that is actually a productive household, which is just so exciting to me that we have an opportunity. I'm our own family. We buy seeds, and Lexi and I are making sure that we plan to support these guys as well. And thanks again, Jason. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Brian. And I'll just so that if somebody's listening and doesn't have a chance to click on it, if you go to seedsgenerations.com/brightheart, that link will take you where you need to go, so they can just remember a simple word link. They can type it in when they get a chance. So we'll have that ready for them.
Seedsforgenerations.com/brightheart. Excellent. So we'll have that in there, and then you guys can support these guys and check it out and get growing your own garden. Just remember as you go about this that the productive Christian household, it's the work of generations. Applaud. There is power there. We say all the time in our family, festin alente, which means make haste slowly in Latin. So take that to heart. Do the next thing, and may the Lord bless you and your household as you do so. We'll catch you next time on Bright Hearth Podcast.